All right. Well, when people think about the fall of South African apartheid, I think the image that is conjured up is Nelson Mandela being released from prison after decades of being locked away. And it's true that this moment was a watershed. So the Australian journalist John Pilger said, this was a moment when it seemed like freedom and, you know, moral power could triumph over any orthodoxy. And Mandela himself, when he was released, when he spoke, when he addressed a crowd at City Hall in 1990, said, "Now is the time to intensify the struggle." Of course, this is not what happened, though. Capitalism was not overcome in South Africa, but actually regained strength and stability after the transition to bourgeois democracy. It had taken a near revolution for the black South African masses to win their liberation, but this was not enough to uproot the entire system. Certainly, this did not come down to a lack of courage or a lack of numbers of brave fighters willing to lay down their lives for the struggle. It was ultimately a failure of the dominant politics, as symbolized by figures like Mandela and of the African National Congress, and also of the left, who failed to challenge them for political leadership of the democratic movement. So how we went from these momentous, earth-shaking struggles to, retreat behind a nationalist government is the focus of this talk. So I'll start by just describing the racist system of apartheid that the black South Africans were up against. So for decades, people were subject to like pseudoscientific, race-based classifications, which assigned them to a different group, based on race. So it was black, white, Indian, which was the, Indian population, and, colored, which was the mixed race population. So I'll just refer, to these categories throughout the talk for like ease, as this is how they're referred to historically. These categories defined everything about a person's life. So where you could live, where you could work, which bathrooms you could use in public, who you spoke to, were all surrounded by these categorizations. And while the measures were about curbing black working class militancy, apartheid grew quickly into an arbitrary system that disenfranchised the entire non-white population. So workers were forced to carry passes, authorising them to be in any white area while they were working, and they were subject to extreme harassment in this. The implementation of apartheid saw mass expulsions of black people from their land, families torn apart and sent to different sides of the country. And the reserves or the Bantustans became dumping grounds for the kind of surplus, unemployed elderly and children of the black population. So in this way, it's clear that apartheid wasn't just a system of white supremacy. It was a system that allowed a small minority of white capitalists to keep reins on the masses of extremely low-paid black workers. Again, this kind of inequality was justified on the basis of separate but but equal national development of black and white nations. But this is like total crap. So the reserves made up only 13% of the country by area, while the black population made up 70% of the total population. These reserves were squalid. They had, you know, homes with hardly any electricity. Until very late in the game, people had no access to indoor plumbing or toilets. And the black councils that ruled over these Bantustans were just mere extensions of the central apartheid government. They policed the populations on behalf of the white apartheid system, so not unlike the Palestinian Authority that we see in the West Bank today. The rulers of apartheid lived in perpetual fear that the black workers they exploited would challenge them for power. So in maintaining this system, they made it so that all political challenge was illegal. So political organizations of blacks, black trade unions, strikes were all totally illegal. So in the end, black workers were extremely resentful, but also extremely powerful. It took immense repression to keep them in line. So what about the question of white workers? Industrial relations laws certainly allowed high-skilled and high-paid jobs to be reserved for whites, while blacks were concentrated in the most laborious and dangerous manual labor. This forced up white wages due to the artificial scarcity of white-skilled labor. So it very much appeared that white workers had a real interest in maintaining unequal conditions. So while white workers, I think, couldn't be a reliable ally, there were actually, you know, white radical intellectuals and students later on in the movement, and trade union officials, but they did play a peripheral role to the whole anti-apartheid movement. Well, as disgusting as it was, the system of apartheid wasn't going to be easily overthrown, and resistance from it initially certainly wasn't coming from abroad. So the United States, the United Kingdom, West Germany, Japan, they all heartily approved of the Afrikaner National Party's rabid anti-communism. And obviously they got extremely, they reaped extremely high profits out of the immense exploitation of the majority black labor. It was only once the regime was on its very last legs that the United States actually imposed sanctions on it. In contrast to this, though, millions of people around the world, millions of ordinary people, were disgusted with apartheid. As early as the 1950s, there were boycotts of South African products, and in the 60s and 70s, there were mass protests, as was mentioned last night in the walking tour, against the racist South African apartheid rugby team that was touring Australia. Including ones organized by students right here at UQ. The trade union movement around the world, including Australia, also had a very proud history of resistance to apartheid. So the Australian union movement, the Wharfies in particular, put an embargo on weapons and oil that was going to be sent to the regime to be used against the freedom fighters. I think while these acts of solidarity certainly encouraged the movement and gave so much heart to the black masses fighting back, they obviously could not substitute for a total confrontation between the masses and the regime. That begs the question then, who was it that would lead the anti-apartheid movement? Initially, it was the ANC, the African National Congress, that offered hope for change in South Africa. And the ANC were no means radical. So they were composed of like conservative tribal chiefs, and more middle class black nationalists who were limited in their careers, political aspirations and education by the apartheid system. They were moderate and they argued for an African nationalist program. So they called for things, they called for mass mobilizations like strikes, boycotts and civil disobedience, but all of this had the ultimate goal of propelling themselves into power. The ANC's strategy basically amounted to a Stalinist stagist theory of revolution, which saw the struggle for democratic rights and national rights taking precedence over class struggle. This political outlook was self-limiting and obviously counterposed to a revolutionary Marxist outlook that argued the struggle against apartheid and capitalism could and needed to be fought one and the same. Despite these political limitations, though, the 1950s saw a massive growth in the civil disobedience campaign led by the ANC. So activists, and this is Nelson Mandela burning his passport in the 1950s. Activists faced up to 3 years in prison, or flogging for engaging in civil disobedience. Despite this disgusting repression though, like tens of thousands of people joined in the struggle. The ANC membership reached 10,000 in the 1950s. And it was in 1955, the ANC at one of their congresses ratified the Freedom Charter, which was a seminal document in the anti-apartheid struggle. So this document promised not just civil and political rights, but also economic rights for black workers. It promised nationalization. It promised wealth distribution, real economic equality. And so, you know, that was also the kind of thing that got workers out onto the streets, fighting for real economic justice. I move on to the 60s now, so a real kind of high point when the struggle begins to take more mass contours. The 60s began with the Sharpeville Massacre, which was the police shot and killed 69 peaceful protesters demonstrating against the pass laws, as mentioned. Following this, the government moved to ban the ANC and other African political groups like the Pan-African Congress. This was when Nelson Mandela was given his life sentence, and that also forced the ANC to look to kind of alternative methods of struggle, like armed struggle. So they formed the military wing of the ANC, Umkhonto we Sizwe, signaling, yeah, that disastrous turn to armed struggle. In this period, there was a real political gap left by the ANC, as most of their leaders were imprisoned, in exile, you know, killed, banned. And so the ideas of black consciousness were very popular, especially, I mean, mostly among the students. These were kind of ideas of like black psychological empowerment and pride that were really influenced by black power in the US. And yeah, in the 60s, the student protests were a really vital source of rebellion against the regime. The activism and radical politics on the campuses, though, didn't just keep the flame alive. It also radicalized a new generation of students and radical academics who would actually go on to form the basis for the new independent trade union movement in the 1970s. So, the 1970s, oh, and there's some students protesting. The 1970s, when the class struggle really begins to take off. So it's in 1973, there's a massive strike wave that begins in the eastern city of Durban, especially at the Coronation Brick and Tile Works. And this is some of the workers involved at this strike. You can see the kind of pride on their faces. A report on this strike said this: "Not one man from the plant ignored the call to strike. They were chanting, 'Man is dead, but his spirit still lives.' 100,000 workers across the docks, the textile factories and manufacturing all came out and joined the fray. And that was half of the African population in the whole city. Solidarity grew between the previously very, you know, separated and disjointed ethnic groups that I mentioned. So despite the intense efforts to keep them apart, the Indian, coloured and black workers came together and confidence just grew massively. This strike wave also resulted in a new wave of black workers entering into like unauthorised independence trade unions. So the five unions that had been set up in 1973 around the strike I mentioned combined to lay the basis for the Congress of South African Trade Unions, which was COSATU, in 1985. This was to form the growth of South Africa's anti-apartheid union movement, which was the crucial thing that actually won the fall of apartheid. And so in this period, though, it's still pretty crazy to think in the 70s, strikes were still illegal. This was all totally illegal. And so every strike meant a total confrontation with the state. The unions continued to grow in the mid-70s, and they won long-fought-for recognition. So tens of thousands entered into the unions, and they won increased wages very quickly. One thing that's really incredible, though, is that it's in from 1970 to 1975, you begin to see black the increases of wages that black workers are winning outpacing those of whites. So in that 5 years, black workers win a 6.6% wage increase and the whites only receive a 1% wage increase. This is like the biggest wealth redistribution that's ever happened in South African history so far. And so it's amazing because even, you know, the workers force the leaders of apartheid to face the reality that their system is coming to an end. One of the disgusting collaborators with the regime, the Zulu chief minister of the KwaZulu-Natal Bantustan said, "I'm not a revolutionary, but I see a revolution coming." Cool. So in the 70s, the international events also begin to have an impact. So the South African Defence Force's invasion and loss in Angola begin to show that the apartheid state wasn't all powerful. There was like news of bars being set alight with cheers and rounds of drinks being bought when black workers overheard that there had been casualties of the white South African forces at the hands of the black guerrilla fighters, in the surrounding countries. And it was clear that the South African ruling class were making political concessions never dreamed of before to the blacks back home. And they were also being decimated by blacks overseas. So a crucial turning point in the anti-apartheid struggle was the Soweto student revolt. So this was started by school students, some as young as primary school, who began a rebellion over the decision of the Worcester government to implement the hated language of the oppressors, Afrikaans, as the language of instruction in the final school years. So in one incident in this rebellion, the protests made international headlines as the police again, without warning, shot on a massive group of 15,000 unarmed demonstrators. The first person they killed was a 13-year-old boy, Hector Peterson, who was shot from behind. And this outraged people internationally, and as well as, you know, it escalated the protests around the country. Despite the just fierce and brutal repression, hundreds more were murdered by state forces. The revolt couldn't be stopped from spreading. So across the country, students were erecting barricades. They were setting vehicles alight, especially cop cars and cop stations. They were attacking any sign of the regime, including churches and bottle shops. One statement from the students at the Athlon Cape School high school in the Cape, I really think expresses the spirit of the rebellious youth in this period. So they said, we want the people to know we are prepared to sacrifice everything. We will sacrifice our careers and our aspirations for the assurance of a more just future. The students quickly realized, though, that they couldn't win their struggle through street battles alone, and they began to call on workers' solidarity for workers to have strikes. Workers too answered with huge general strikes in all the major cities, aimed at overthrowing the whole apartheid system. So again, in Cape Town, there were some of the biggest political responses to these calls. So the Wednesday following the outbreak of the Soweto revolt, 70% of workers stayed away from work. And on the Thursday following the revolt, it was 80 to 85% of all workers stayed away from work at the behest of the students. And again, just so people can get a sense of what the mood was like, there was like hundreds of unauthorized strike leaflets appearing in workers' mailboxes and street corners. Most of them were anonymous. Some were put out by the ANC. One said in Cape Town, "The racists do not spare their bullets. They cut down our march for freedom, but our march for freedom must not end. Reject all concessions the racists grant us. Concessions are crumbs. We want freedom, not crumbs. That's why we need to strike." The revolt continued, and 1976 saw three more political general strikes, which were called stayaways, in response. So one of the stories told after the revolt concerned a section of school students in 1976. They were looking for socialist literature. They were asking for texts that had been around in their parents' generation, recommended by the Communist Party. This kind of subversive literature had been banned for 25 years in South Africa under the Suppression of Communism Act. But it was now, in the heat of struggle, that the students were looking for new answers to old problems. So the students were not content with the kind of simplistic descriptions that said, you know, all the ills in South African society are because the white man is in charge. They wanted to understand, at least in part, they wanted to understand capitalism, class struggle, imperialism, and the state. The tragedy, though, was that the political leadership at the head of the movement, the ANC, had little to offer in terms of this, and the students, the brave students at its head, just lacked experience. So many thousands of the best student fighters went into exile, or they went and joined the MK guerrillas. Despite their initial enthusiasm, too, workers couldn't stay away forever without being given a political lead. The student struggle had serious limits in that it couldn't totally pull in the working class behind it. While there was a fast turnover of students, you know, corresponding to the nature of student life, students are quickly in and out of school and university, workers had the capacity to develop long-term networks and organizations that could, you know, stay the long game, to stay for decades in the anti-apartheid struggle that would be needed. But this kind of organization failed to take place in the Soweto revolt in what could have ultimately been a revolutionary situation. So now I'll talk a bit more about some of the economic changes and the attempts at political co-optation by the regime in the 80s. So following the global recession in 1975, the apartheid regime faced stunted economic growth. They were much less likely to give out big economic concessions to workers as they had previously. At the same time, though, the workers' movement gained in strength and confidence. They'd won the right to strike, they had union organization now, and their membership trebled from 220,000 in 1980 to a massive 670,000 in 1983. So there were bitter debates too in the union movement between different factions known as the populists and the workerists. So the populists were the dominant faction in COSATU, the dominant trade union federation. And the populists included the Stalinist South African Communist Party. These groups supported ANC politics, which was primarily that of a popular front against apartheid. Those members of the SACP argued that the struggle against apartheid had to be, you know, you had to subordinate the struggle for socialism to one after the end of apartheid and after you know, bourgeois democracy and black rule had been won, with the ANC crucially being, you know, the force that had to come to power. The populists in the trade union movement, crucially those in the National Union of Mine Workers, which was the most powerful and dominant, saw their role as giving the ANC the political lead and just subordinating the unions to their command. The workers were a left-wing current centered on a block of key trade unions and an earlier configuration, an earlier trade union federation named COSATU. These groups articulated a perspective much closer to syndicalism. So they placed a primary emphasis on class and the need for independent union organization. They were actually for socialism. These people were very critical of the regimes in, you know, Stalin's Russia, or not Stalin's Russia by this point, the Soviet Union in the 80s and China. and they emphasized rank and file involvement in the unions, arguing the democratic workers' movement needed to give a lead to the township movements. Although they had a mass following in places like Alexandria, though, the workers ultimately failed to pose a political challenge for leadership of the movement. Despite their left-wing politics, a key failing of the workers was that they did not build a socialist political party to challenge the ANC and SACP for political leadership. This is at a time when millions of workers are engaged in radical struggle against the system, but with the lack of a credible revolutionary alternative, they ultimately fell behind the dominant politics of the ANC, which called for a mere transition of the leadership at the top of South African capitalism. So in 1990, COSATU officially allied to the ANC, forming the now infamous tripartite alliance between the Union, the ANC, and the South African Communist Party, which holds up to this day. So, by the mid-1980s, the scale of struggle was so great that large sections of South Africa became ungovernable. School students boycotted their classes and barricaded the universities. They demanded free education and an end to educational apartheid, the deep inequalities that still remained in the education system. There were four more general strikes between 1984 and 86. The largest was on May Day in 1986, involving 1.5 million black workers. And in 1987 was the biggest strike in South African history, which was when the mine workers went on strike. Despite this kind of earth-shaking rupture, still the regime dug its heels in. So the regime declared a state of emergency and they arrested 26,000 trade unionists and activists. It's important to acknowledge too, like the role that the Bantustan leaders played, the kind of black, tribal African leaders. So they showed pretty quickly in this period what side they were on. They mobilized to maintain their privileges and crush the revolt. So one of the most notorious of these figures was the chief minister of the KwaZulu Bantustan, Buthelezi. He sent in thugs, not to fight racists, but to fight the anti-apartheid fighters and to put down a revolt of black workers against the struggle. His forces slaughtered more than 200 in an uprising in Alexandria in 1986. The SACP for this part too were equally treacherous. So they urged workers not to strike, lest they contribute to the violence. This is despite the fact that a general strike could have stopped the thugs of the tribal chiefs and the government forces in their tracks, stopped the whipping up of different ethnic tensions and brought the working class together despite these tensions. This whole episode, though, had faced the ruling class with a question. It was either transition to majority rule or face the very real prospect of revolution from below. From their point of view, it was much better to allow a handful of black capitalists a seat at the table rather than risk further rebellion. So, by 1989, the regime is in total crisis. The Great Township Uprisings had shown that the majority were no longer willing to live under apartheid, and the state of emergency had only bought time. Underlying the risings of the 1980s too was a structural change in the economy. So as shortages of skilled labour had emerged, whole sections of the ruling class were disregarding apartheid laws anyway. They needed to employ blacks in skilled labour to actually keep up production and be able to meet, the needs that industry demanded. The political impact of the anti-apartheid struggle too was having an effect, an impact internationally. So workers around the world just could not look on dispassionately at the struggle that was happening and urge their governments to act. And it was the state of emergency imposed by the apartheid regime that finally forced international capital to draw a line and impose sanctions on South Africa and, you know, finally draw a line in the sand, they wouldn't continue trade with them. So in August 1989, President de Klerk made the decisive move of unbanning the ANC, the SACP, and freeing Mandela. And this was a prelude to full-scale talks. He pressed for a settlement that would grant the white regime favourable concessions. The ANC leaders, for their part too, though, wanted to use the mass movement as a bargaining chip to squeeze concessions out of the white establishment. They were eagerly willing to trade away parts of the ANC program. So things I mentioned earlier, they had promised workers' rights, wage increases, nationalization, wealth redistribution. All of this was traded away before it was even necessary, easily handed over. The union bureaucrats of COSATU too agreed with this approach. So in the 1990s, they began negotiating with the government and employers' organisations to establish a social contract similar to the Australian Labor Party's Prices and Incomes Accord. However, it quickly became very clear that the negotiations by the government were not in good faith. The security forces were once again trying to whip up violence, and so again, the ANC, like clockwork, had to turn back to the masses to shore up their bargaining position. On the 3rd to the 4th of August, 4 million workers took part in a massive political general strike. After this demo, the National Party could no longer harbour any illusions about the depth and extent of popular support for the ANC. At the same time, though, the business community really relaxed about the prospect of ANC leadership, and this was reflected in the fact that 68% of business leaders in South Africa supported Mandela for president. Basically, they welcomed an end to the instability, and so it was in 1992 that the apartheid legislation was finally repealed. And in 1994, that Mandela, the first black South African president, came to power. Well, just to start drawing together some political conclusions. The historic achievement of the first black president, I think, was much less the result of the skill of negotiation of the political parties that led it, but much more than of mass struggle. It was the risings of the 1980s and what they represented, not merely the incredible courage of the township youth, but the power of organised black labour that had even forced de Klerk to the negotiating table in the first place. The ANC had been happy to mobilise the masses, but as soon as things were about to get out of their control, they mobilised their networks to put a brake on struggle, even if it meant weakening their own position, as in the early 90s negotiations. For them, the struggles of the masses were a mere means to an end, the end being the ANC assuming political power so they could bring in limited reforms for ordinary people and better serve not only the aspirational middle and black bourgeoisie, but the white ruling class too. So the day after Mandela's powerful speech, where he argued to intensify the struggle that I referenced earlier, he began to correct himself. So majority rule would not make blacks dominant, he said. There would be no public ownership of industries and no economic democracy. Reassuring the white establishment and foreign business, which had established and maintained apartheid, was the political agenda of the new South Africa. And Stalinists, liberals, the communists all complained after the election about the unmanageable expectations of the black masses. But really though, it was these people, the oppressed and exploited, that had won the struggle against apartheid. And often when you ask people, they made it clear they were fighting for much more than a new constitution. They were fighting for, you know, national liberation, or some people even said socialism, real economic democracy. There was a reason why the red banners of the Communist Party had been proven so attractive to the militants and black youth. These fighters, though, were betrayed by a leadership that never planned on meeting their demands. So South Africa today is wracked by just as much poverty and inequality as in apartheid. In fact, today it is one of the most unequal countries in the world. Segregation exists in everything but law. And so I think to challenge this situation, to fight for the real economic equality that people talked about, the immense power of the African working class will have to realize its full potential. To have a chance at winning the real democracy, the class will need to have to organize itself independently under the banner of a revolutionary workers' party that won't settle for just the hated crumbs that the militants so despise, but for total economic and democratic liberation.